Jane the Not Cinema Virgin, in honor of Gina Rodriguez in Annihilation, what currently airing sitcom actor or actress deserves to transition into real films?
I'm Katie Rich, and I'm going with William Jackson Harper, aka Chidi, on The Good Place, though I am obligated to mention that he did have a role in the very good indie film Patterson. He deserves even bigger parts.
I am Matt Patches, and I am going to go with, after watching some Howard Hawks rom-coms over Valentine's Day, specifically His Girl Friday, I really, really want a younger star, Sutton Foster, to be in like a classic rom-com. It's never going to happen, because they don't make them anymore.
Hey, it's me, David the Seven. I'm going to say Manny Jacinto, which I think is how you pronounce that. Sorry if I'm wrong. Who plays Jason Mendoza on The Good Place? I'm not sure what sort of movie he would be in, but I'm guessing a comedy is what I would enjoy seeing him in most. So let's go with that.
Dude, Where's My Car remake?
Yes. Where's my space Tesla?
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good. Then, well then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room. It's episode 203, and it's Tuesday, February 20th. And on this day in 1952, John Huston's The African Queen was released. I have never actually seen it.
Oh, my God. Like, it's on Netflix. Go watch
it. Is
it right
on Netflix?
Now. Yes.
Oh, man. No, I have so many of our Quarter Quell movies to watch.
Yeah. True. It's really enjoyable. I like that.
Viral marketing for the Quarter Quell. Someone should have picked The African Queen for
I'm
one of
confirming,
us.
Yes. Humphrey Bogart, Katharine Hepburn, African Queen. It's on Netflix. Everyone should watch it.
Yeah. Or you can watch the movies that we're going to be watching for our Quarter Quell, which we tweeted about and posted on Facebook. That's going to be recording soon.
Oh.
You should watch the movies.
Well, you should mention
about.
Them here. You should mention
yeah.
them now.
We,
this is a good
see,
idea.
Let
so
me see if
don't
I can.
Have reviews.
Yeah, so we're going to. David's not with us. He is at the Berlin Film Festival, so we're going to not talk about reviews this week, but we can talk about the movies we'll be talking about on the Quarter Quell, which we are planning to record next week. I'm not going to try to do it by memory. We are watching Bahubali, The Beginning, which is a Bollywood movie. The Hindi version, I don't know
it's
if
it's not
Hindi
a Bollywood
and the,
movie.
Oh, okay, sorry. A movie from India. How's that?
Someone corrected Dave on Twitter, and I just want to correct it here. It's not a Bollywood
movie. We're going to learn a lot. So anyway, we're watching the Hindi version, not the Tamil version. I don't know if they're different, but that's what we'll be watching. That's Dave's assignment. David's assignment is the German film Liebe mich, which I don't really know much about, except that the title is Love Me. I'll be watching the Korean film Train to Busan, which I'm sure will ruin my life because it's supposed to be scary. And Patches is watching the Brazilian teen romance, The Way He Looks. All of these movies are on Netflix, at least in the U.S. So watch along with us.
Yeah. And the African Queen.
And the African Queen. That'll be my reward when I'm done.
The real river trip was the friends we made along the way. We're about to see the release of the adaptation of A Wrinkle in Time on March 9th of this year. A Wrinkle of Time is a Madeline L'Engle book, the first in a series that involves bending space and time and angels. But we're not really going to get into that as much as we're going to get into rereading a book that is about to become a movie. Adaptation is one of my favorite things about talking about pop culture. Because, you know, stories are interesting when viewed from different angles. And what I'm hoping to see with Ava DuVernay's A Wrinkle in Time, which is
guys,
notably,
we have the worst pronunciation troubles on this podcast. It's Ava DuVernay. It's just Ava.
Ava DuVernay. Thank
oh,
you.
Oh, DuVernay.
Yes. I say that only because Dave Joanna called us out recently and said that we were the good ones. So I want you to stay on Joanna's good side.
Yeah, she's always on top of me. I've explained this once before on Storm of Spoilers, but I'm hitting like this weird thing where my inner monologue becomes my writing, so I teach myself how to say things to make me spell them correctly, and then I can't learn how to say them.
Yeah, that's fair.
I just say that to talk myself out of. I'm not trying to be offensive. I just end up being offensive, so that's, if that makes anybody feel better. Most notably, it's going to be a blockbuster film with a woman director that has a budget over $100 million, which is amazingly the first time this has happened. So there's a little
and
bit...
Go ahead.
No, please.
It's an adaptation of a book that is about white people that has cast a very multiracial cast. Specifically, the father in the family is white, is Chris Pine, and the mother is Gugma Mbatha-Raw, is black, and it's a mixed race heroine at the center of the movie.
Wait,
which
is the book
cool.
explicitly white?
In
white
in the book, the mother is described as having flaming red hair, so she is very explicitly white. And then you can guess, you can decide from there. And then Calvin is also described as being explicitly white. So yeah, it's explicit and then implicit for the rest of it.
And so I guess, in order to prepare ourselves, both Katie and I went back to reread the book, which I hadn't read probably since middle school in its entirety. I will cop to one thing. When I went to college, I found the audiobook very soothing to fall asleep to. Because if you haven't read A Wrinkle in Time, the first chapter is Meg sort of waking up in a storm, and she goes downstairs, and her brother's making her food, and her brother's kind of psychic, her little five-year-old brother, Charles Wallace, and is able to, like, pinpoint everybody's favorite food, and then a mysterious witch shows up with water in her boots from the storm. And I never really had to go beyond that chapter to sort of lull me into a weird zone of comfort, because it isn't until after that chapter that the weird woman with water in her boots ends up being one of three witches, and these witches help our titular character, or not a titular character, she's not called Wrinkle, our main character Meg and her little brother Charles Wallace and their friend Calvin travel beyond the known universe to rescue Meg's father, who has been missing after doing experiments for the government. And then this book series also goes on for four more books. I had to just look over my shoulder, the bookshelf, to see how many more I had to go.
You can call it the Time Quintet if you want to be fancy.
Yes, thank you. The Time Quintet. And I don't know, Katie, if you remember how it ends, but I realized now reading Wrinkle in Time, I don't really remember how the entire arc ends. But
the only thing I remember is that there's a whole book about her twin brothers who go back to the time of Noah's Ark, and I don't remember how that happens.
What?
Or why. I love some revisionist history, so I remember that.
I never read any of the sequels. I remember reading the original book back in like elementary school or something, but none of the sequels.
There's
it did not spark like Narnia for me.
There's definitely another book where you meet Meg as an adult, and maybe even Charles Wallace as an adult, so it spans a good bit of time.
Yep. Interesting, but it also gets slightly more Jesus-y as it goes along, which is the only thing I really remembered about the book. And I was surprised to see Wrinkle in Time had more of that than I remembered it having. They mentioned that Jesus and Einstein and Shakespeare were people fighting the evil darkness, and that the three witches end up being celestial beings that are messengers from God, so they don't say angels, but it's implied sort of angels and how wondrous they are to look at and whatnot. Mixed with some really high sci-fi concept things like the actual Wrinkle in Time and a species that can't see and a whole bunch of more interesting fantasy concepts. So I don't think it's full-on C.S. Lewis Jesus-y, but I am interested to see if the film adaptation is going to be able to escape that, because it's not really present in this first book. I don't think it needs to be present in order for this movie to have, I think, a slightly more mass appeal without necessarily even bringing religion into it. I don't know. Katie, do you think it's necessary to be that faithful to that part of the book?
No, I think the parts of the book that, like, we were talking about this before, that there's a concept, kind of the most, I think the only time the name Jesus is ever mentioned is they're talking about, like you said, the people who have fought this darkness over the years. And I kind of like that as a sciencey version of, you know, the way that they believe in Islam, that Jesus was a prophet of God the same way as Muhammad. Like, there's kind of an embrace of great thinkers. That seems totally fine to me to keep if they want to. But the rest of it, it's like, you know, there are people quoting scripture, including the witches, and yeah, I just feel pretty certain that's not all going to make it in there. And I don't know. It, from my memory of the Narnia movies is that they went gentle enough on the religion that you could see it if you were looking for it. And that feels like to me what they would do with this, so that they don't alienate the Christians. Because you know those Christians, they buy tickets in bulk. And I'd be very intrigued to know if Disney has a like church marketing campaign for this that they're keeping relatively quiet.
Oh, that's interesting.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of people who care about religion that would be interested in having this movie be religion adjacent or Christian adjacent.
Yeah.
Not just like white people or something.
But this movie also isn't, you know, the message of this movie isn't like there is a savior who has been reincarnated to save you. It's kind of specifically about the opposite and about saving yourself and being resilient. So I don't know if people are as attached to it as they might be just like the Narnia books.
This is what I wanted to pick your brain about, because this weekend I was sitting around listening to, I turned on the radio and it was the New Yorker Radio Hour on NPR, and they just so happened that Ava was doing an interview with somebody at the New Yorker, and it was kind of about her whole career. They spent most of the interview talking about her work, on her television show where she tries to get a lot of female directors, and she talked a lot about black representation. She talked about making the documentary 13th. And it's funny because the end of the interview was like, oh, we were kind of doing this because you've directed A Wrinkle in Time, and maybe we should ask you about it. And the question was really just like, so how's it going? How is the movie? And I was really surprised that DuVernay said that she was really hesitant. She was really defensive, like right off the bat. And I was surprised about that. But I also know that Ava is a publicist at heart, and she knows how to approach these things. So I don't know if the movie will be good or not, but she's extremely defensive right off the bat. Saying,
What do you mean? Yeah.
Well, I'll quote her. She says that while she's proud of the film. I'm looking up these exact quotes because it was a little peculiar. She basically says that I don't know how it's going to be received, and that she is describing Madeleine L'Engle's novel, and that it's obviously close to the source material, but it's about a girl saving the world, and that girl is a girl of color. She's saving the world. She's saving the world from darkness. And the film, Darkness, is defined as the darkness within us. She's saving us from ourselves. And from there, DuVernay talks about how with 13th, she said, you know what, I'm just going to make this movie. I don't care. This is what I want to put out. If people get it, they get it. If they don't, I'm on to the next. And with Selma, I was like, you know what? I'm nervous. It's my thing that kind of has a faux pas, and I know that I believe in this. I know that this is a record and it needs to be there. Some people are going to get this. And then she's referring to A Wrinkle in Time. She doesn't know if people will get it. And I think that's really interesting. She later in the interview goes on to say that she hopes that like in 50 years, someone will come up and be like, A Wrinkle in Time was fantastic. It's a cult film. People actually loved it the whole time. Like, what is it about the source material that makes this movie potentially risky or potential to be misunderstood by an audience? Like, overtly with the trailers and stuff, it doesn't seem that different or that risky or that like built out of either like black experience, which she seems to be leaning on, that having a black girl might confuse people, or her vision of a planet might be really weird and different.
Well, I think that's the cool thing that I think gave me some hope when I was reading the book, because even though I didn't like it as much going through it the second time, there is a lot more in it where Meg is describing how indescribable something is, and I was like, this is perfect for somebody if they really have a world building sense. And it sounds like, you know, she really exposed herself doing that and is kind of afraid about it coming out. But that's a good sign for me, because that's what I want. I want someone to take a risk with this thing. And, you know, if you have a book like A Wrinkle in Time where you could be very faithful to it, but then it also gives you so much leeway in creating planets and creating species and trying to figure out what, you know, this food that's supposed to look disgusting but taste horrible, like, actually looks like on film. I think that's a place that we could see a lot of unexpressed creativity. I would be worried about it if I were her, because there's just not a lot of plot.
Yeah.
So whatever they've decided is the ending of this movie, it's going to be really interesting to see how it's built to it. It's not like there's an action sequence or a big, you know, character showdown. It's a whole bunch of descriptors about why the certain actions that are being taken are working. And it's going to be interesting to see how that translates to a big blockbuster Disney movie.
Yeah, and to go back to what you were saying about Ava DuVernay being a publicist, like, I think this is kind of, I feel like this is something she said about a lot of her films, where it's like, if you get it, you get it. If you don't, you don't. And like, I don't know, like, obviously she's probably hedging because she's made a huge movie and there's a lot of pressure and everyone is aware that she's, you know, I guess especially after the release of Black Panther, it's like, okay, Disney's making movies by Black people, like, they got to succeed. And I would imagine that puts some pressure on her. But I don't know. I don't take that as her being defensive already. That seems kind of like a natural position to take, because I'm sure there are crazy racists calling Disney every day outraged that they cast Meg Murray as a black
for
girl.
Sure.
And for I mean, sure. And also maybe she's seen tracking numbers that we haven't that say it's going to not be a huge thing.
I mean, it's a tough, it's not like a Beauty and the Beast remake. It's not a the 18th Marvel movie that just happens to, you know, be Black Panther. This has a lot more of an ask from audiences.
Yeah.
No one, I imagine that most people are not like you rereading the book in the months to come, or may have never read it in the first place, actually.
Yeah, I think it's definitely probably going to play more like original sci-fi than anything else. And, you know, they've been advertising the hell out of it. So I'm hoping, like, I think regardless of how the movie turns out, like, I think it's a net good thing to exist as if, you know, for adapting classic children's novels, it seems like a good way to do it.
Should our listeners be running out to read through the book just like we did?
It's a short book. I think especially if you read it as a kid, it's a really interesting thing to revisit. I mean,
what a sell.
Yeah, I think I'm with you, Dave, is that it's like it felt much stranger to me as a book than I remembered. And I don't know if that says a lot about the book or like what you want in a book as a kid. But there's interesting stuff in there. And I'm going to keep reading it because I like these characters a lot. And I want to, you know, keep up with Meg and Charles Wallace. And that might be reason enough to read it, even if the book is kind of odd.
Yeah, it is. It's an odd duck. I don't know how I accepted a precocious 5-year-old the way I did, because that book just, he's suddenly there, and it's going to be interesting to see how the movie deals with it.
Yeah,
my
feelings about child actors are really going to be tested by whatever happens with Charles Wallace in this movie.
I'm fixing a hole where the rain gets in and stops my mind from wandering.
All right, this weekend, Black Panther cleaned up. What is the weekend total? I assume Dave knows this off the top of his head.
Oh,
how much money did this juggernaut
off the top
movie
of my
make?
Head. I think it's going to get to what? It's definitely doing over 200
it's
million
heading
domestic, and it's going to maybe get close to 400 million international, but 380s is probably safe.
Box
heading towards
Mojo.
A 235 million.
Yeah,
million.
But that's a 4-day weekend, so you got to...
well, it's a good weekend to put out a movie.
Outgrossing the not Zack Snyder cut of Justice League in 4 days.
And we all know if Zack Snyder's cut had come out...
Then it'd be a different story.
$1 billion. Yes. So obviously this movie is a huge success. It's the ramifications of its success are yet to be seen. Will they make lots of... Will Ryan Coogler make more movies? Will Marvel blow up Black Panther into their new strategy for Phase 4, or, you know, Black Panther leader of the Avengers or something? Will it be a takeover, or will it also have implications with Hollywood culture in general? Will we see more black-led blockbusters? I think everyone hopes for all three of these things to happen. And but I took some notice in the week... And was Dave tweeting? Dave, what was your tweet? Do you know what your tweet was?
You say the word tweeting.
It wasn't
like
a very funny
like shitting
tweet.
In public.
Yeah, look at
was,
Dave tweeting.
I mean,
just Dave and the president making fools.
I do
out
consider
of themselves.
Tweeting to be basically shitting in public. But Dave, what did you tweet?
So
I'm happy to quote you.
This
too,
Monday, I tweeted: at this rate, Ryan Coogler will have a Star Wars trilogy by next week.
Now, Dave, what the fuck? Don't say things like that.
Why not?
Because even if you're joking, it might be real if you do. Obviously, the people who follow Dave on Twitter loved this idea. People were just gaga for Ryan Coogler's Star Wars trilogy. And on some level, I mean, it does make sense and it sounds kind of exciting. Star Wars, Lucasfilm, and Kathleen Kennedy have taken a lot of flack for many of their choices over the last few years as they're building out the Star Wars expanded universe. Most recently, David Benioff and D.B. Weiss of Game of Thrones, they've been added to the story collective. They're going to write their own trilogy of films, or they're going to write their own series of films, as they put it.
Not to mention all the white guys they've hired and fired.
That's true. That's true. I mean, the list goes on and on. But we also have Rian Johnson actually making Star Wars movies coming up. And it seems like there's been a slight pivot in the Star Wars universe. They were planning to do a lot of prequel movies with characters people love. That seems to have slowed down. There's not a lot of traction for that news. Dave, am I wrong? Like, Solo seems to be the outlier here.
Yes, correct. They've been hesitant to pull the trigger on, most notably an Obi-Wan Kenobi movie, which is definitely something that has existed in the thought process and probably exists in draft. But they just, haven't got around to saying that's actually happening yet.
Yeah. I mean, so obviously the idea that Ryan Coogler just struck big with Black Panther, and that he is a visionary filmmaker who was able to inject some personality, to inject experience into this kind of blueprint of a Marvel movie, it's really exciting. And you could see that people would be frothing at the mouth for him to get his hands on Star Wars and take it to a totally different direction. But to that, I say, nay, Dave, terrible idea, terrible idea. And to everyone supporting Dave on Twitter, stop it. Stop talking about good people entering the Star Wars universe. As I said last week, one of the kind of down... Actually, I like the action in Black Panther more than some of the other co-hosts of this podcast. David hated all the action in Black Panther. How did you two guys feel about that?
I liked it. Car chase was great.
I was fine with it. I didn't hate it.
I mean, the Marvel-y ending of Black Panther was bad. I'm sorry. The train fight is bad, but... Katie, I'm glad to hear that you and I are on the car chase.
I like the big battlefield stuff, too.
Yeah, he's got a handle on some of this action. It could probably be better. We've seen Creed. We know that he's capable of some, like, mano-a-mano
Creed,
fighting.
Creed, also a franchise film, by the way.
Yeah, well, it's funny. After the box office numbers started to come out, a lot of people were comparing Ryan Coogler to Steven Spielberg and saying, has there ever been, like, a kind of 1-2-3 punch of, I think in Spielberg's case, it was like Jaws, and then I don't even know.
Jaws.
Someone fill in the blanks.
ET, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's...
Isn't that the order?
Banger. Yeah, that makes sense. And it's humongous. And he was working in original blockbustery mode. And then people comparing Coogler to that, it's like Fruitvale, Creed, and then Black Panther. But like, remember, he was directing Creed, the like eighth movie of a long forgotten series, a dusty series. And then the 18th movie of a machine entity in the mega franchise world.
What's your point?
I understand, but why do we want to see Ryan Coogler locked into these franchises?
No, this is the question.
If Hollywood cared about Ryan Coogler, if Disney cared about Ryan Coogler or his vision or the black experience on film, then Ryan Coogler would get to make original blockbuster movies. It's, as I said last week, it's time for someone to get to make their Mad Max, and it should be Ryan Coogler. But it doesn't mean Ryan Coogler should make Star Wars movies. The what?
He's like my age. No, I think, okay, I hear what you're saying, Patches, and I respect...
The next step of all this conversation is like actual representation and actual vision and actual handing over $150 million to a visionary filmmaker like Ryan Coogler and getting to see what... a black filmmaker could make when he's not being put into a mold that's lasted 30, 40, 50 years.
So that's what Ava DuVernay is doing with Wrinkle in Time?
I mean, kind of. Less.
It's an adaptation. As we just talked about it, it's more like original sci-fi than an adaptation.
It definitely seems like it gives her more latitude. But again, like the Disney machine, she's still adapting properties that they own and their IP back.
Also, Cloverfilm Paradox is a black filmmaker making a pretty much original sci-fi story.
That what is
Cloverfield Paradox?
Right. I mean, kind
didn't turn out great, but that is what that is.
They're looking for what it looks like. Lucasfilm is doing is they're looking for filmmakers that are going to be able to chart the path to whatever the after is after the Star Wars saga, because it's not continuing to mine George Lucas's ideas. Apparently, that's not working out the way they want. So what I'm saying is the way that we invested in George Lucas after one teenage roadster movie and got the Star Wars trilogy, why not invest in Ryan Coogler and let him do his Afrofuturism with laser swords? I don't see why that's bad. It's not like he's going to have Darth Vader and Stormtrooper.
What you're describing. George Lucas didn't get hired to do the Star Wars trilogy.
No, but that's what they're
got carte blanche, and he chose to make the Star Wars trilogy.
But it's Rian Johnson isn't doing the rebellion in the Empire. He's doing something else. They're saying he's doing something else. So we don't know.
You still have to play in the sandbox. We all know that, like, Kathleen Kennedy in the Lucasfilm machine is very strict about what happens in these worlds that they're creating. Just because you get to go into a different corner of the sandbox doesn't mean you still have to play there. I'm talking about handing a guy who has connected with audiences around the world with his experiences and his vision and cutting him a check to do something totally original and start creating new IP because we're out of IP. I mean, that's such a crass way of putting it, but, like, there's not much more to do with Star Wars. And I love Star Wars.
I mean, that's cute that you think that we're out of Star Wars IP, because what I'm trying to tell you is they're hiring...
I don't really think that.
They're hiring people to create more IP, and you want people like Ryan Coogler and not people like the Game of Thrones guys to be making that new Star Wars IP, because I, you know... If you look at the screenwriting credits of the Game of Thrones people, there's Game of Thrones and there's bullshit like Wolverine. So, like, I don't know what Ryan Coogler has done that makes him not deserve Star Wars. And I get your impulse that, like, let's not lock people down. Let's give them carte blanche to do whatever they want. But what do you think the reality is of what I'm saying is going to happen versus what you're saying is going to happen?
I guess what I'm saying, well, the reality is that it's probably he has to go do a Star Wars movie, or he has to go back and make a personal film for $20 million, which is just...
Or he does what Patty Jenkins does and negotiates like crazy and gets paid for the Black Panther sequel, which I hope is what happens.
Maybe. I'm just saying that, like, in a world, in a year where we saw Get Out made like $250 million and Black Panther just cleaning up, like, why can't we... Is IP innovation truly dead, where we wish to see Ryan Coogler make a Star Wars movie? It's not that he couldn't or that he doesn't deserve to. That's not what I'm saying. Like,
he's good at it. Two out of his three movies have been IP innovation.
He is. But what? No.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wait, what? That's what you were just saying, is that they were both in franchises.
Yeah.
No, but when I say IP innovation, I'm talking about creating something brand new that people could be reaping.
Oh, you're talking about creation
for 50 years. So, yes. Okay. Creation.
Yeah. 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 Okay. So there isn't any, there isn't a lot of evidence that Ryan Coogler is good at that. There's a lot of good world building that's happening in
Black
Panther.
Who can be good at it now, though? Who can be good at it now?
Good at what? Like creating something out of nothing?
Yeah.
I've been trying to say that Wes Ball needs to be getting in on this, but, you know, people are saying that he hasn't proven enough by doing Maze Runner adaptations. But I think there are good people doing world building. All I'm saying is that in a world that Ryan Coogler has made me interested in more Rocky movies and more Black Panther Marvel movies, why wouldn't I want him to make me interested in Star Wars movies?
Can I make my best argument against Ryan Coogler making a Star Wars movie? I feel like I addressed this some in the Black Panther review, that one of the most powerful things about the movie to me is the way he connects it to reality, and he connects it to Oakland and kind of makes it about real life Black people suffering. And it made me think about Avatar and the way that when you're making a movie about a culture that has been kind of infringed upon and making it outer space, it's pointless because we have so many of it here. And I feel like Ryan Coogler making a movie not set on Earth would be a real waste of that, the way that he can kind of put his passion for social justice and, you know, the ways that Black people have been treated in society. Like, don't put that in Star Wars. Let him keep make as much sci-fi as you want, but I feel like he should stay on Earth.
Neil
Blomkamp that we need.
You know what? That would be fine.
Yeah.
So, guys, I gave you a slightly last-minute assignment to look at the Oscar-nominated shorts, which are playing in theaters now. They're playing at my local art house. I know that they have been available on iTunes in years past. I'm not totally sure they'll be on iTunes now, but some of them are on HBO, some are on Netflix. And they're really interesting if you have a way of seeing them. And what we all managed to watch is, or at least most of the animated short nominees, which includes kind of the requisite Pixar movie and then some really interesting and weird animated shorts. Dave, as our animation expert, what grabbed your attention from this group?
Ooh, so what grabbed my attention from this group? Everything from this group, as I think should be in every award nomination category, is an animation thing I would hate to do for my job. Dear Basketball is a Gil Keen animated story of Kobe Bryant that has some amazing pencils and the in-between artists that make that style work. With the way it works with focus is absolutely amazing. Garden Party is very realistic and is about toads exploring a very peculiar environment that I'm sure we'll talk about later. But that's
in the spoiler section for the animated shorts.
The spoiler animation section. But that's like amazing photorealistic detail. And then in multiple times of day and with a whole bunch of moisture around. Very interesting. Lou is the Pixar one you were talking about, which does a lot of interesting things with creating face-like forms out of random objects. Negative Space is stop motion and is about a man's relationship with his father and how they used to pack. And just the way that that packs literally within itself, just trying to make all that as physical objects, one, I wouldn't want to do. And second, there's one part where he's making clothing ebb and flow like a tide.
Yeah.
And just doing that in stop motion would be absolutely...
Or like underwater creatures, where it's got like the underwear swimming like a fish.
That's just got to be...
I like where he's driving along a zipper.
Yeah, I like that too.
All great design. And then Revolting Rhymes is... I think it's CGI models. For some reason, the screener is only 540p.
Yeah.
Is based on the Roald Dahl book of the same name. And looks like a moving Roald Dahl illustration. It's the most blue sky-y animation of it. And I don't think it has a ton of like texture on the models outside of like the wolf. So I'm going to say that's the one that probably stood out to me the least. But Garden Party is amazing because it ends up being, here comes the spoiler section, at the house of a murdered person who is at the bottom of the pool and like pops up at the end. And so you're seeing...
And the murder person might be Donald Trump?
Or at least bears a strong resemblance to Donald Trump.
And
especially
Trump.
As a bloated corpse, which is maybe the most visceral thing I've seen. Like, I don't know when I've seen something that, like, truly, like, grabbed my soul in that way. And I haven't watched my Quarter Quill assignment yet, so maybe that'll be the next one.
Yeah. But it's, like, really interesting because the other mini frog stories that are in Garden Party... Or like one's chasing a butterfly because he likes butterflies and one's trying to eat all this food left over in the house. And
there's like a love story going on.
Yeah, the fat toad's trying to flirt with the skinnier frog. And these all sort of like resolve in like animated short
film. And it looks beautiful.
It looks good.
Yeah,
it looks
beautiful. I mean, like the photorealism of these frogs is just stunning.
Yeah.
And then you start seeing like close-ups of smoking guns and strewn about papers and you're like, wait,
bullet holes.
Something is wrong.
Yeah. And then then the corpse emerges and starts floating in the pool and it is as textured as the rest.
Whew.
So I'm going to say if I'm going to have to choose between two of these for my personal Oscar, it narrows down to Garden Party and Negative Space. Just for execution of animated concepts.
Yeah, I see what you mean about the quality of Dear Basketball as animation, but I thought it was such a crazy, self-serving, nonsense movie where it's Kobe Bryant narrating the story of how he loves basketball, accompanied with shots of the highlights of his career. And I just couldn't, like that was the only one in good conscience. I was like, if that wins, I will throw something at my television.
Well, I mean, it's interesting. You're right. It is definitely, like, hagiography produced by...
Narrated by the person it's about.
And he's now Kobe... Brian is now nominated for an Oscar because
yeah.
That said, I woun't mind seeing this movie win because Glenn Keane is this
Gil Keane,
legend
right?
Of animation. Glenn.
Oh, I thought Dave said Gil. Never mind.
I might have said that, but I would probably have been wrong.
I think there's a famous Gil in animation. Anyway, Glenn Keane has not directed many movies. He just got a deal with Netflix, oddly enough, to direct a 2D animated feature for Netflix, which is really, really cool. But he's been a character animator on, like, every Disney animated film that you care about. You know, Beauty and the Beast, Little Mermaid, Aladdin. He worked on Paper Man, the animated short from a few years back that I think won the Oscar. But he has not directed that much, so this is kind of like a huge deal for him to be funded to get to do a film and actually be up for this Oscar. And probably win. I mean, I think the competition is not stiff enough for anyone to kind of bounce them out of.
Yeah, even the Pixar shorts, like, played in front of Cars 3 and everyone kind of forgot it existed. I really liked the Pixar short, honestly. It was a, you know...
What did you like about it? Because I don't really... Like, Pixar shorts, why have they all seemed to fallen into a groove? Like, why are they all the same?
They do have a weird similarity to them about, like, you know, cultures and someone not fitting in and then finding a way to fit in as a result. I don't know. It was a sweatshirt doing nice things for kids and helping a kid. I mean, it rips off the Ratatouille shot of the film, the critic kind of flashing back to his childhood, like, so directly that I guess it's an homage to themselves, but I was kind of surprised by that. But, you know, it's an effective shot.
Yes, he has baseball eyes and he's a sweater running around. It's kooky.
Yeah, it's cute. I mean, I think probably Garden Party or Negative Space would be the ones that, like Dave, that I would root for here.
Negative Space is probably too arty. Who votes for the shorts? You're the master.
I believe everyone does. I think that all of the categories get voted on by everybody in the nomination, in the actual winners process. So presumably they get screeners of the shorts and have the opportunity to watch them. What they actually vote for is debatable. I mean, Revolting Rhymes, which we haven't talked about much, is the longest in there. It's got like a bunch of famous names in it. So like that might be the one that people commit themselves to watch. But the fact that these are all really short, like they're very easy commitment to make. So hopefully people actually watch them.
Yeah.
And Revolting Rhymes is actually on Netflix for people who wanted to see that.
Yeah, it's good, but I don't think it adds anything that isn't in the book. Dominic West is good in it.
Yeah.
I'll give him that. He should just do the Roald Dahl audiobooks now.
Oh, yeah, that'd be a good idea. So then, Patches, you watched two of the live-action shorts, too, of the five nominees. Which ones did you watch?
I did. I watched... I need to put them in front of myself so I know what they're called. They are called DeKalb Elementary by director Reed Van Dyke, or Dick, and The Silent Child, directed by Chris Overton and written by Rachel Shinton. Did you watch these two films,
Yes,
Katie?
I watched all of the shorts. Thank you very much. And yes, I watched those two. And DeKalb Elementary, I think, was my second favorite of the live actions.
What was your number one?
The 11 o'clock is the one that I like the best, and it's probably lightest. It's about... a psychiatrist and his patient who show up for a meeting and have a very like quick-witted back and forth banter discussion about maybe which one of them is the real doctor. And it devolves from there. And it's just like, it's Australian and is charming and well-acted. It is the one that stars two white guys. So it feels like not the like hippest one to like best, but I enjoyed it immensely. One of them is about Emmett Till. Silent Child, which you mentioned, is about like deafness and children. DeKalb Elementary is about school shootings. And then Watu Wote, All of Us, is about like Christian Muslim violence in Africa. So it's you definitely, if you want to be important, you would go with anything but the 11 o'clock.
Yeah, I think that, you know, watching the shorts always makes me think about how short films work and how... Sometimes I watch the shorts and I think you can just see them chasing the Oscar. Like, the shorts actually feel like the most Oscar baity of all Oscar categories sometimes when the drama is heavy handed, or in the case of The Silent Child, which, as you described, is about a deaf girl whose parents, this is a British film, her parents do not seem that interested in like helping her cope with her deafness and integrating her into their family and the rest of life. She's about to go to school. And so they hire a sign language teacher to kind of get her ready for school. And then they kind of cut her out of her life because, I don't know, she forms too close a bond. The teacher and the student form too close a bond, and the parents are
I don't know. They're worried about that. There's paranoia.
And it's the kind of movie that ends with like a title something like "Real children suffer from this every day. Go to
this
website to do more," or whatever.
Yes, it's a message movie. It's clearly, it just wants to hit you with that message card at the end that's like 80% of deaf children do not get the help they need. Go to this website. We stand with deaf children. And it's like, okay, you could just make a movie that makes me extremely empathetic and I could probably learn some of this. I don't need to be slapped. And I feel like too often short films are gunning for the message. You know, the animated shorts end up excelling more for me because they're shorter. First off, most of the live action films nominated for the Oscar are about 20 minutes long. And the animated shorts just have this kind of like punctuated, it's either a joke or it's an emotional beat, or they deal in brevity because of time and money constraints, in a way that live action short films, they're either like burdened by dialogue, or I remember once, you know, I went to NYU film school and I had a teacher there who she selected the short films for the Tribeca Film Festival. And she was teaching us why she was yelling at us about this, but she was like, never put title cards in your short film. Never have title, like intro titles. And of course, The Silent Child, this one that I watched, opens with like, starring this person, and here's the title. It's like, you have only so much time.
Yeah.
Can we get to the point?
Yeah.
Like, tell us the story. And there's too many messages. Now, you and I both watched DeKalb Elementary.
Yeah.
By director Reed Van Dyke, who is just some white guy from LA. Congrats to him for getting nominated for an Oscar. This is a pretty heavy movie to be watching a week after a mass school shooting.
Yeah, I watched it before the most recent mass school shooting, and I imagine it's much heavier viewing.
Oh, you watched it before? Oh, okay. Yeah, I had maybe a slightly different experience a few days after this Florida incident.
Not that school shootings are something that I feel comfortable with in under normal circumstances.
Right, right, right. Yeah, right. Yeah, it's disturbing no matter what. It was just especially poignant now. Basically, the movie takes place entirely in the main office of a high school, and a kid just like barges through with an AK-47. He's like, I'm going to shoot everybody. And he does it, and it's all about like him and the administrative woman working things out, and her becoming extremely sympathetic to him, and him actually hearing this woman. Katie, talk to me about this film, just about like, I mean, people can go and see this movie. It's easily accessible. So
is it?
We're just going to completely spoil it. Yeah, I mean, like you said, it's going to be on iTunes eventually. It'll be out there somewhere. People can see this movie. But I want to talk about the drama here, and especially because I feel like we're going to see more movies about this. I feel like this topic especially is, we saw Dark Knight, which was about the movie theater shooting after The Dark Knight Rises came out loosely, and we've seen Elephant in the past. School shooting movies are a thing. I feel like they're going to be more of a thing soon, and people are going to take advantage of the inherent dramatic quality.
I want to see where you're going with this, but then I want to redirect you but go ahead.
School shootings becoming more, let's just not accept as a given that they're going to become more of a thing. Anyway, what I think this did, I mean, I think the school shooting background of it obviously gives it a lot of tension. Like, you feel the stakes of the situation immediately. But what I thought was impressive about this was, first of all, just like using not a huge budget to make a film. Like, they got access to a school front office. They had two good actors, and that's kind of all you need. And you've got so much implied going on around them, but it's all using audio.
Unlike The Silent Child, which is full of drone photography, if you're going out to make your short film, I feel like this segment is a little bit of a lesson in like what good short films are all about. And one thing that good short films are not about are drone shots.
Yeah.
And lots of them.
Yeah.
Because they always look like drone photography. They look so bad.
Okay. I was talking about DeKalb Elementary. I
really want to lean in and slam The Silent Child. Sorry, it's bad.
What I think DeKalb Elementary is more about is just like treating a person as a human being, which I think is the power of it. Is this, you know, this woman diffuses this awful situation by being a person, and she's clearly terrified. And I don't think she's like, I don't think we're having over like too much sympathy for this guy. Like, he's there to do something horrible. Like, I don't think it's trying to like make him out just to be like a misunderstood white guy with a gun. But it's showing a real connection between them, which seems valuable, not just in the situation of school shooters, who are really hard to empathize with, but, you know, white nationalists and like all the awful misunderstood white guys who are out there. Like, we get really frustrated with them for good reason, but I feel like the idea of an actual human connection having the power to diffuse the worst possibilities is really valuable.
This is a perfect example of what we talk about when we talk about, like, privilege interfering with telling a story, telling a true story. I'm really receptive to the complaints that people have about, like, what does it mean to have a white director make a movie, and how does drama play out in these scenarios? And I think about DeKalb Elementary, which the administrative woman at the school, which is clearly in the South because the guy who barges in with the AK-47 is, like, a lumpy Southern white guy. On purpose.
Apparently it's inspired by a real school shooting incident in Atlanta.
I'm sure. The administrative woman is a black woman. The entire movie is her kind of talking him off the ledge and him being really, like, upset that he decided to do this, that maybe he's like, I've made a mistake, I should go to the hospital, I'm out of my mind, I want to die, but, like, I've made a mistake, I don't actually want to kill anyone. And her being like, I really understand you, and I feel you, and just put down your gun, and everything will be okay. And that's, like, the whole movie. But where it doesn't make sense to me is the actual politics of this. Like, this black woman being really receptive to him and this white guy being understanding and of his own predicament, or him being, like, turned into a sympathetic figure that needs to, that deserves to be talked off the ledge in this case. Like, come on.
So, going to barge Matt in Patches, or give Three Billboards a chance, is turning on DeKalb Elementary. For being like, maybe the politics of this story are inherently wrong.
I think...
Okay, the world of Three Billboards, I don't need to relive this conversation, but I've made my case
I
on
think
that.
You're maybe,
and if you disagree, fine.
Like, I think I you're maybe reading the movie is more sympathetic to the guy than it is. I feel like it's more about what she's doing to survive and how she's using being an empathetic person as a survival tool, less than making him seem sympathetic. Anyway, go ahead, Dave.
Maybe.
I want to jump back to what... Patches was saying about, like, how sometimes these shorts feel like they need to force a point, or how Silent Child ends with a title card. Like, it's always interesting to me, I think the reason so many of those things get through is because the situations under which short film is made. It's a learner's medium at best and an advertising medium at the professional level. Like, there isn't, outside of the Oscars, for live action short film, there isn't a huge market for it that I know about. Like, the fact that you can now take it to iTunes or take it to Netflix is super exciting, because I don't know what it would have been in the pre-internet era. Like, you know, we would occasionally get Brothers Quay VHS tapes or something. Like, I don't know what it is. But, like, even with animation, you have studios that need to make a name for themselves or are trying out a new technology. So there's a reason that you have people dabbling in super narrative things or things that are trying something. And documentary shorts, I think, is about forming a story that has to, like, fit. But especially these live action shorts, I think the reason a lot of them feel rote is because it's not a medium that's expressly built for anything but flashes of genius. I think the backbone of everything has to be, like, really sturdy, regardless of what that thing is. If that makes any sense?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean...
It does. It's... Yeah.
It is a short medium in which to express yourself, and I think what you said about it being, like, a learner's medium is the most important thing. And what I think I get out of, especially these live-action ones, is seeing a flash of a filmmaker I'd maybe want to see more from, which was maybe the best that you can hope for. And the value of these Oscars is that it gets these people on such a visible stage so early in their careers.
It's just interesting that literature has found room for short film as not a learner's medium. You know, we have George Saunders,
I mean, short
and
stories.
Jhumpa Lahiri, and Wells Tower, and Juno Diaz, and, like, people who've really made a name for themselves as short story writers. They're not just experimenting. This is their preferred medium, and they can make a really blunt point in a brief amount of words. And why can film not do that? Why does short film have to be a learner's medium? I don't really understand that.
I mean, I think it's something about your quality judgment of a blunt point in those mediums. So if you're saying that a blunt point is fine in short stories, but a blunt point is clumsy in short films, then that's the way you take
it.
Well, but I mean, like,
what
you're
saying, the animated films end up being more successful because of their constraints, and they seem to. I find a lot of short film, live action short films to pine to be feature films. Like, they are too big for their britches in some ways. The Silent Child is exactly like
that. But DeCab Elementary isn't, someone, I think.
DeCab Elementary is definitely the best one. Well, I've only seen two of them. But it is exactly what a short film should be. A scene or a moment kind of boiled down. And yeah, I think if it had been a little more successful in its drama, you know, it's filled with dialogue, which is usually also poison for short films. But it's definitely the right direction. It is a successful short film.
Patches, I think that doesn't I recommend to you The 11 O'Clock, which is, I think, a well-sized short film and has a ton of dialogue. But maybe to wrap it up, I can talk about the documentaries briefly.
Yes, please.
So unlike...
Thomas Lennon directed one of these movies.
Is that Thomas Lennon? I wondered that.
Yes, it's Reno 911's Thomas...
Wow. And that one is about a restaurant in Cleveland, Ohio that employs people recently released from prison and teaches them how to cook very gourmet French food as a way to kind of avoid sliding back into jail. I think unlike many, many years, none of these movies are about the Holocaust and none of them are even about war. Are they all made in the U.S.? Yeah, they're all American, which is also feels kind of unusual. One of them is about a couple who get married in their 90s and are kind of being separated by one of their children. Heaven is a Traffic Jam on the 405 is a really interesting movie about this artist and a woman who's like suffered with mental issues her whole life. She had lobotomy as a young woman and yet makes this pretty incredible art, and it kind of is used to animate the film. Heroin is on Netflix. I know that one for sure. It's about these women who live in Huntington, West Virginia and work in various ways to combat the opioid epidemic. Knife Skills, I mentioned about the prisoners.
I should say Knife Skills is not directed by Thomas Lennon.
Damn it!
I'm sorry. I apologize.
I assumed it was not.
Someone had said that. I'm like, oh my God. And now I looked it up to confirm. I got caught by fake news.
Apologies fake to news. The real Thomas Lennon, who we gave credit away from.
Who has done many short films about food, I believe.
And then the last one is Traffic Stop, which is on HBO. And it's about, I thought that one was, this one was really interesting because it's about a woman in Texas, a black woman who was stopped by the police. And you kind of think you know where the story is going. And it is a bad encounter with the cops, but she doesn't die. She doesn't have any like lasting wounds or anything, but it's kind of about the psychic impact of this incident that in the scheme of things like doesn't seem as major as like Sandra Bland or Trayvon Martin, but you see like what a difference it's made in her life and how she thinks of herself. And I thought that was a really like a valuable perspective to take on as we talk about police brutality, that it's happening so often to very normal people and they don't make headlines because it's not as dramatic, but it can be just as harmful. So I liked that one a lot. I feel like Heroin is probably the one that would win. It's got visibility on Netflix and it's also really good. Most of these do not make you want to die, although none of them are super like encouraging. So tread carefully. Not a lot of comedies in the documentary short field.
Change that, Patches. Next year.
Yeah.
We'll make a funny documentary.
Get Thomas Lennon to actually make a documentary.
Yeah, Eleanor
Rides a Bike.
Oh, I hope it's not funny.
It'll be funny.
Like Eleanor riding a bike next year is not going to go well for Eleanor. No,
might be really
she'll
funny.
She'll be 1 year old, really probably not the most skilled. Would be funny, though.
Let's all vow to make short films in the next year that we see.
Can it be Charlie climbs a slide that's too big for him? Tune them. That does it for this week's Fighting in the War Room. We'll be back next week with our Quarter Quell with David Ehrlich safely returned back from Europe. Please go check out the movies that we were watching that we mentioned at the beginning of the show. They're on Netflix. It will be fun. In the meantime, tell the people who you are.
I'm Matt Patches. I'm the entertainment editor of Thrillist.com. I am on Twitter at Mr. Patches. We have a website, FightingInTheWarRoom.com, where you can listen to the episodes. You can share them with friends, or you can leave your thoughts on this year's short films, Oscar-nominated short films. We will look there and probably communicate. That's FightingInTheWarRoom.com.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. Spell my first name, DA70. That's also my Twitter handle. You could find my work there, including Black Panther stuff for Thrillist. I'm going to have something for IndieWire at some point. I don't know when, but you should also go to IndieWire because that's where David Ehrlich writes. He's going to be writing stuff from Berlin. And he's one of our podcast hosts when he's not out of town. And, well, didn't leave us an Ambien message this time. And I'm sure apologizes to all of you for it.
I'm Katie Rich. I just looked up all the shorts will be available on iTunes and Amazon on February 27th, so if you don't have long to wait. You can find me at vanityfair.com. I'll be on the podcast Little Gold Men this week talking about these shorts more, if you want to hear me talk more about the depressing ones. You can also find me on Twitter at Katie Rich, K-A-T-E-Y-R-A-C-H, and we're all on Twitter at F-I-T-W-R, where you can talk to us about whatever you want, or also answer this week's lightning round question, which was,
in honor of Gina Rodriguez in Annihilation, what currently airing sitcom actor or actress deserves to transition into real films?
Thanks for listening, and we'll be back talking to you next week.
Stack bodies, not figurines. Move beneath the surface, submarine. I'm half machine, obscene with a light sword. Look inside the brain, it's a riot in the psych ward. What you standing on the side for? Roar like a lioness, punch like a cyborg. Spit slick, attack is subliminal. Flowers on my mind, but the rhyme style's sinister. Stab behind my own bars like a season.